Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today we open our show with some breaking news out of Sacramento on new state rules for reopening schools. Hear why schools in many California counties, including San Diego, may not be reopening this fall, and what it will take to get kids back to school. Next, we'll have a report on some improvements to firefighting resources as we enter peak fire season and how evacuation shelters will be changed to adapt to the COVID-19 pandemic. And then, in a special report, hear about a shocking new allegation made in a new claim by a former Navy officer who says while she was waiting at a gas station for a ride after leaving a protest in downtown La Mesa May 30th, a law enforcement officer allegedly pulled up and shot her in the breast with a projectile believed to be a rubber bullet. El Cajon has just approved a grant to help local businesses impacted by the pandemic. Lemon Grove has also approved a similar grants program to provide aid for its small businesses. An investigation by East County Magazine has resulted in major changes to the County of San Diego's stimulus grant program, so many more local businesses in the unincorporated areas can now qualify for the grants as well as nonprofits that are volunteer-run. After the state ordered many indoor businesses to shut down, El Cajon City Council got busy and approved letting businesses such as retail shops, salons, and barbers move outside. But there's a major obstacle some are hoping to change, a state regulation that limits barber and beauty shops to operating inside. The city of Poway has approved a plan by Mayor Voss to let fitness businesses and worship services use public parks during the pandemic. And while some churches and other religious organizations are moving services outdoors or online, some local churches are openly defying the shutdown orders, risking a crackdown by new enforcement teams set up by the county and state. There's also a lawsuit filed challenging the state's ban on singing during worship services, an action taken after many cases of COVID-19 and some deaths were tied to church choirs spreading the virus. Speaking of the virus, Spring Valley has the worst rate of positive test results for COVID-19 countywide. Hear how your community compares on today's show. El Cajon's Planning Commission will soon be considering emergency sleeping cabins for the homeless amid a shortage of shelter beds during the pandemic, and we'll have details. Community college sports fans won't have a lot to cheer about since the fall and winter season has been canceled. From California News Service, hear why Medicare is shortchanging many children on wellness checkups. Then we'll have a report on deadly rabbit hemorrhagic fever found for the first time in San Diego County. And we'll take a trip down memory lane with a replay of our interview with Dick Panic from the Railway Museum in Campo on the colorful history of our local railway. Debbie Schultz, who headed up the county's Foster Parent Association, was murdered along with her daughter in Otay Mesa. Now, the organization based in El Cajon is in severe need. Find out how you can help on today's show. And finally, we want to invite our listeners to tune in to KNSJ again tonight at 7 p.m. for a special virtual book tour show with internationally acclaimed investigative reporter Greg Palast. His sleuthing has led to major exposés on scandals ranging from the Exxon Valdez oil spill to presidential elections. He'll be presenting findings from his new book, How Trump Stole the 2020 Election, The Hunt for America's Vanished Voters. You can sign up to watch on KNSJ's Facebook page, where you can also make a donation to support KNSJ Radio, news in the public interest. Now stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. On Friday, Governor Gavin Newsom announced a 5-point plan for reopening public and private schools in California, but 30 counties currently on the state's COVID-19 watch list are prohibited from reopening schools this fall, including San Diego County, unless conditions improve dramatically and soon. A 5-point plan issued by the state's Department of Public Health will allow a district to reopen for live classes only after its county has a 2-week decline in COVID-19 cases. So if you want your kids back in school, folks, wear those masks. The news deals a blow to districts such as Cajon Valley Union School District, which just resumed some summer school classes and had announced a blended learning model that gave parents options for in-school, online, or a combination of learning options. Some other districts, however, such as San Diego Unified, had already rolled back reopening plans due to high numbers of COVID-19 outbreaks locally, as has the Los Angeles School District. But the governor warns that districts must fulfill their obligation to teach students despite the challenges of distance learning. He said in a press conference Friday, "Schools must, and I underscore must, provide meaningful instruction during this pandemic, whether they are physically open or not." Now that means daily live teaching and vigorous curriculum requirements, according to the state. Schools that reopen will have to require masks for children in third grade or higher, and also for staff. The state has purchased 18 million child-sized masks, the Sacramento Bee reports. Only children with certain medical exemptions will be exempted from wearing masks, and a child without a medical exemption will be sent home if they refuse to wear one. Everybody entering a school must have a screening for temperature and symptoms. Teachers and staff will be regularly tested for the virus each month. If a teacher or student tests positive, the classroom would be shut down and quarantined for 2 weeks. If 5% of students and/or staff become infected, the whole school would be closed. And if there's a widespread outbreak, an entire district potentially could be shut down again. The governor's budget allocates $5.3 billion in education funding to help provide distance learning when needed. That includes buying laptops and academic intervention help for families who lack resources. The action comes after teachers' unions and other educators lobbied the governor to block school reopenings due to the skyrocketing rates of COVID-19 across California. Kevin Gordon, a lobbyist who represents California school districts, praised the governor for putting the health of kids first. But June Duenas, executive director of the nonprofit Support for Families of Children with Disabilities, says keeping schools closed will increase hardship of families with special needs children. Duenas says, "We have single parents living with two kids with disabilities in a small apartment and they can't go out, and obviously it's really, really stressful. A family who has a kid with autism that used to have school all day for their kid and an afternoon program were able to work, and now they're taking care of this kid 24/7. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Governor Gavin Newsom has announced new efforts to combat wildfires and protect firefighters, as well as evacuees, from COVID-19 as fire season approaches. The state will hire 858 more firefighters and 6 California Conservation Corps crews through October due to the pandemic. Governor Newsom says, "Even in a challenging budget climate, we have undertaken major action and made significant investments to fortify our state and help fight increasingly severe wildfires." CAL FIRE completed the last of its 35 emergency fuel management projects in May, making 90,000 acres safer to help protect 200 vulnerable communities. The state has also added new Firehawk helicopters and C-130 air tankers to CAL FIRE's air fleet, as well as bolstering firefighting surge capacity. The state has also worked to develop early warning technologies and install fire detection cameras. This year's budget included $85.6 million for permanent firefighting positions and technology to model fire behavior. Ahead of wildfire season, the state won critical safety victories from PG&E to make the utility more accountable. The governor also signed SB 350, which provides major consequences if PG&E doesn't act safely, potentially even including a company takeover. The state also beefed up requirements for utilities to invest in wildfire prevention. All three large investor-owned utility companies, including SDG&E, have acted to reduce power shutoffs by hardening infrastructure, vegetation management, improving weather modeling, and sectionalizing the grid, so if shutoffs occur, only small areas would be taken offline. CAL FIRE Chief Tom Porter says wildfire season this year carries an extra layer of danger as the state responds to the spread of fires and the ongoing health pandemic. "It is of the utmost importance that we keep our crews healthy so they can continue their work and that we adjust evacuation and shelter plans to protect communities from the spread of COVID-19. CAL FIRE has adjusted firefighting operations to limit spread of COVID-19 in its crews by holding virtual meetings and keeping non-essential base camp staff off-site. The state has updated protocols for evacuation shelters to require health screenings, dedicated cleaning staff, prepackaged meals, medical and mental health professionals on site. If evacuations are needed, the state is prepared to secure hotel rooms, college dorms, Airbnb lodging, fairgrounds, and campgrounds to allow people to shelter in non-crowded settings. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is Miriam Raftery with an exclusive special report. A woman who claims she was shot in the breast with a projectile believed to be a rubber bullet by a law enforcement officer has filed a claim against the city of La Mesa. The incident allegedly occurred while she was waiting at the Chevron gas station for her daughter after leaving the protest on May 30th. Michelle Horton, a white, 51-year-old Navy officer and healthcare administrator, is represented by attorney Gerald Singleton. In an interview with East County Magazine, Singleton said Horton left the protest after a dispersal order was given. The shooting allegedly occurred between 8 and 9 p.m. by an officer who, according to Horton, pulled up in a squad car at the gas station and shot her in the chest without warning. The filing follows an earlier claim filed against La Mesa by Leslie Furcron, a protester struck in the head who was seriously injured and lost vision in one eye from a beanbag fired by a La Mesa police officer outside the police station during the tense May 30th protest. During that chaotic situation, around the time Furcron was shot, Horton and her daughter became separated. Her lawyer says Horton called her daughter to go home and went to the Chevron station near City Hall to wait. When an officer pulled up, she had her hands up to show she was unarmed when she was shot, Horton's lawyer claims. Singleton says the gas station has informed him that it has surveillance video showing the incident. He intends to obtain it once a court issues a subpoena, a process that will likely take about 20 days. Our media outlet has asked La Mesa police and the city manager for comments, but so far they have not responded. Although the claim is against the city of La Mesa, it should be noted that Singleton acknowledges the alleged shooting could have involved either a La Mesa police officer or a sheriff's deputy, a crucial detail that the video or public records may provide. Sheriff's deputies were present at the time, but La Mesa police were in command at that hour, according to a timeline released earlier by the city. Horton seeks damages for her injury, and she has suffered flashbacks and nightmares since the incident, according to her lawyer. A related but separate taxpayer claim for injunctive relief has been filed by a La Mesa resident because Horton lives in Bonita. The taxpayer claim seeks to have the city halt use of projectiles, such as rubber bullets and beanbags, as well as tear gas for crowd control. Tear gas is banned in international warfare. Singleton notes that Horton, a white woman of petite stature, is not the usual kind of suspect in police violence. He concludes, "What I really hope people take away from this is that this could happen to anyone. If you're not even at a protest, and you just happen to be standing near there, this could happen to you." Attorneys for both Horton and Furcron, along with lawyers representing additional injured protesters, held a virtual press conference Thursday, along with the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, and the Coalition for Police Accountability and Transparency. At that press conference, several claims were announced countywide alleging police misuse of force against protesters. Another claim has been filed against the county and city of San Diego on behalf of Roslyn Cassidy. She claims that an unknown officer fired a rubber bullet or other projectile and injured her as she was leaving a protest in San Diego after an unlawful assembly was declared on May 31st. Her suit alleges negligent training of law enforcement and contends there was not ample time provided after the dispersal order before she was fired on, sustaining an injury to her side. At the virtual press conference, the group also called on local elected officials to adopt a police accountability now package of reforms that includes limiting discretionary stops by police, establishing independent police review boards, adopting de-escalation policies and policies to limit use of force, as well as shifting some funds from police budgets to invest in non-law enforcement options. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
El Cajon City Council has unanimously approved a plan to allocate almost $2.5 million for a business grant program benefiting primarily non-essential businesses forced to close during the pandemic. Under the business grant program, non-essential businesses will receive 70% of the funds in grants up to $30,000. Restaurants will receive 10% of the funds with grants up to $10,000 each, In addition, essential businesses which lost more than 50% of their sales will receive the remaining 20% of the funds, with grants up to $15,000 apiece. The grants are to be used for payroll, rent, and utilities. The money from the Federal CARES Act, distributed through both the state of California and San Diego County, must be spent by September 1st, so the city is on a tight schedule to distribute it quickly. Applications for the grant program went live on Wednesday, July 15th, and will be available for just 2 weeks until the end of July. A new business grant committee, made up of 9 people including El Cajon business owners, faith-based leaders, and a former city manager, will then decide which businesses to allocate the money to by the end of August. To qualify for the program, businesses must have a business license, be within city limits, and not have current code violations. According to the city, hundreds of businesses were already contacted by city staff and business groups doing outreach and have expressed interest in receiving a grant. El Cajon is facing competing interests in how it allocates the grants, helping as many businesses as possible while still making the amounts meaningful. If all businesses that apply receive the maximum amount, only 114 businesses will receive grants. Funding more businesses, however, could have resulted in cash infusions too paltry to be meaningful for many recipients. If some businesses seek less than the maximum, then more businesses can be helped. In total, El Cajon has now allotted $3.1 million from the CARES Act. An earlier round of CARES Act funding went mostly towards rental assistance programs and to help homeless people. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
This is John Sepulveda with this East County Business Update. El Cajon businesses are going to be moving outdoors. This comes after the state shut down many indoor businesses and activities due to a spike in COVID-19 hospitalizations. El Cajon City Council voted on Tuesday to help many businesses and activities move outdoors. Outdoor activities are considered safer by health officials since the coronavirus doesn't linger as long in hot, sunny conditions, and since people outdoors are not breathing recirculated indoor air. So as Californians return to stricter lockdown measures, businesses like retailers, hair salons, and barbers that are prohibited from operating indoors can now apply for a permit with no fee to move their business temporarily onto sidewalks or parking lots in El Cajon, similar to how many restaurants have moved services outdoors. While it may not be practical to move all services outdoors, being able to maintain at least some income during the new lockdown could mean the difference between survival and permanent closure for some struggling local businesses. But there's one key obstacle remaining, and that is the California Board of Barbering and Cosmetology has sent a letter to salon and barbershop owners warning them that their licenses only allow operations inside their establishments. So a coalition of barber and beauty shop owners from El Cajon and elsewhere are asking the governor to issue an executive order to waive that rule and allow such services to occur outdoors temporarily. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is John Sepulveda.
The Poway City Council on Wednesday unanimously approved a sharing outdoor spaces plan proposed by Mayor Steve Voss. The plan allows local fitness businesses and houses of worship to temporarily use spaces in public parks at no cost until indoor restrictions imposed by the state are lifted. The action comes after the state earlier this week issued an order requiring houses of worship, gyms, yoga, dance, and other fitness groups, as well as certain other businesses, to cease all indoor activities until further notice to reduce spread of COVID-19. Outdoor activities are considered less risky by health officials because the virus dissipates more quickly in sunshine and warm weather, and since people are not breathing in recirculated air. Use of parks would be limited to houses of worship based in Poway and fitness organizations with a Poway business license and insurance that must be changed to have the city as an insured party. The city also requires that all COVID-19 safety guidelines be followed, and that includes rules requiring face coverings and social distancing. While it's unclear whether any significant number of outbreaks of COVID-19 have been linked to gyms and fitness activities, outbreaks have surged among members of churches that have reopened nationwide, even at some congregations that wore masks and did practice social distancing, the New York Times reports. Whether outdoor services will prove safer remains to be seen. California previously recommended, but didn't require, that people refrain from singing during worship services, since singing has been shown to easily spread the virus through droplets. Some houses of worship ignored those guidelines, though, and new outbreaks did result at those churches. But banning worship services poses First Amendment concerns. And while some services have moved online, fellowship through religious services provides support at a time when many people need help as they're struggling to cope with isolation, job losses, and other issues caused by the pandemic and quarantine. Besides helping churches and fitness businesses move outdoors, Poway earlier approved buying picnic tables for restaurants at the suggestion of Mayor Voss. Those tables have been loaned to local restaurants moving outdoors temporarily due to health orders. After the restrictions on indoor dining are lifted, the picnic tables will be relocated to parks in Poway, making the action a win-win for restaurants and park visitors. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
An East County Magazine investigation has resulted in major changes to the County of San Diego's stimulus program, making more small businesses and nonprofits eligible as a result. On July 7th, the county announced its plan to use $17 million in CARES Act funding to provide grants to help local small businesses, restaurants, and nonprofits that suffered financial losses due to COVID-19. But East County Magazine's special report exposed that documents required in the application would prevent most businesses in the unincorporated areas of the county from applying, as well as nonprofits that are volunteer-run. The application originally required all applicants to have a business license, but the county no longer issues those to businesses in the unincorporated areas, so only businesses with a license in a city could apply. The application also required documents to prove employment and payroll deductions, which nonprofits that rely on volunteers only don't have. Yet those nonprofits have lost significant revenues due to being unable to host fundraising events and donations down due to the pandemic, limiting their ability to fund needed programs and services. After East County Magazine brought these flaws to the attention of Supervisor Diane Jacob, the county changed its rules. And we're pleased to announce that a business license is no longer required of businesses in unincorporated areas. Proof of employees is also not required for all volunteer nonprofits now. Businesses and nonprofits are urged to apply early for the county grants. Applications will be accepted through October 16th, but only if funds are still available. For-profit and nonprofit businesses can apply for grant money if they can show losses and costs are a direct result of the pandemic. To qualify, they must have 100 or fewer employees, headquarters in San Diego County, at least 1 year of operating history as of February 14th, documentation of financial hardship because of COVID-19, and you can find more information as well as the application by visiting the stimulus website. That's sandiegocounty.gov/stimulus-grant. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
By a unanimous vote, Lemon Grove City Council on July 7th approved allocation of federal CARES Act funding. The city will receive $480,774 distributed through the county and another $334,243 through the state. The lion's share will be spent to help small businesses. Some will also offset city costs related to COVID-19, while a small sliver of the funds will be spent on homeless services. Lemon Grove will use $650,000 to establish a Small Business Emergency Relief Fund to help small businesses impacted by the pandemic. Eligible businesses can receive up to $10,000. To be eligible, a business must have between 1 and 20 employees as of March 1st of this year, hold a valid business license, and have a physical location in Lemon Grove. Home offices are not eligible. Franchises, chain stores, nonprofit groups, corporations, government organizations, school districts, and private community organizations are also not eligible. Examples of businesses that are eligible include restaurants, bars, breweries, gyms, spas, salons, mechanics, and small retail outlets. Funding can be used to cover COVID-19 related expenses such as back rent, outdoor dining or sales plans, personal protective equipment, and testing for employees, sanitizing, and other costs to comply with health regulations, expenses due to remote working, payroll, unemployment, and health insurance costs. Another $150,000 will be spent to cover costs for keeping city employees safe from the coronavirus through personal protection equipment, remote working equipment, child care for essential workers, increased sanitation, and employee testing. A very minimal amount of CARES Act funds, $15,000, is allocated for homeless outreach and help for homeless people through the city's nonprofit partner, Home Start. Lemon Grove City Council also voted unanimously to put a cannabis tax on the ballot in an effort to help balance the city's budget. Although only medical marijuana is currently legal in Lemon Grove, approved by the voters under Prop V, the new ballot initiative would also authorize the tax on other forms of cannabis, so that if uses such as recreational marijuana, cultivation, or manufacturing are ever legalized, the city will be able to tax those, too. Reporting for East County Magazine in Lemon Grove, this is Jonathan Getz.
Some local churches are openly defying California state health orders that temporarily prohibit indoor worship services due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A lawsuit has also been filed challenging a state ban on singing and chanting during religious services. Many churches, synagogues, and mosques have shifted to online worship services, services broadcast over TV or radio, or outside services including drive-up versions. But others are planning returns to indoor services for their parishioners despite health risks and bans by both state and county governments, claiming religious freedom. Skyline Church is inviting its parishioners to RSVP on its website for Sunday services in Rancho San Diego, including some inside auditoriums and a gym. The Awakened Church in Kearny Mesa has promoted in-person women's prayer meetings at all of its locations. When contacted by ABC 10 News, a pastor at Awakened claimed the prayer meeting was actually a prayer protest, but indoor protests are also banned under Governor Newsom's order. It remains to be seen how many parishioners will actually flock to attend illegal indoor services amid a pandemic. One megachurch parishioner, a senior with a heart condition, told us, "I wouldn't go anywhere near a church right now until there's a vaccine." Enforcement of county and state bans on illicit indoor services is up to the sheriff in unincorporated areas, and in cities, enforcement is up to each city's police department. Sheriff Bill Gore has previously enforced county health orders against other local churches that held services during an earlier shutdown. One local church, the South Bay United Pentecostal, filed a lawsuit claiming that ban was unconstitutional, but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4, finding that restricting worship service during a pandemic is constitutional. Despite that ruling, three Northern California churches have filed a new lawsuit, this one seeking to overturn the state's ban on singing and chanting during services. The suit contends that the ban violates the First Amendment freedom of religion. The risk of religious services becoming super-spreader events is a valid concern. Over 450 cases of COVID-19 have been tied to churches or other religious institutions in the U.S. since the start of the pandemic in March, the New York Times reported, and some participants have died. A Virginia pastor who refused to require social distancing during services died of COVID-19 in April, and last week, a Houston pastor also died of the virus. At least a dozen leaders of the Church of God in Christ had contracted the coronavirus as of mid-April. The Sacramento Bee documented back in May numerous cases of COVID-19 spread specifically by choirs, and studies have shown that singing can spread droplets and the coronavirus farther than talking. Now, as of our show taping deadline, both the state and county have promised to dispatch enforcement squads to assure that health rules are followed. So, religious groups that hold indoor services or include live songs may soon be facing the music, legally speaking. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
San Diego County has released data showing the percentage of people who tested positive for each 100,000 in the population as of July 8th. Spring Valley ranked by far the worst, with over 2,000 positive cases for every 100,000 people. In other words, more than 1 out of every 50 people has COVID-19. That's quadruple the rate of any other East County community. The city of San Diego, which has 44% of all cases in the county, has a positive rate of 553 per 100,000. Rates are also high in Chula Vista and National City. It is unknown whether some small rural and mountain communities may also have high positive rates on COVID-19 tests, since towns with less than 100,000 people living there were not tallied. As for total cases, El Cajon has the most of any East County city, with 875. Spring Valley has 574, La Mesa 282, Lemon Grove 183, and Santee 159. In all, unincorporated areas account for 12% of all coronavirus cases in San Diego County, while incorporated cities account for the remaining 88%. County health officials urge residents countywide to maintain social distancing, wash hands frequently, and wear masks when within 6 feet of others not in your household, as the law requires, to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This is John Sepulveda with a sports report. Local college sports fans won't have much to cheer about until next year. That's because the California Community College Athletic Association's Board of Directors has voted to delay intercollegiate athletics to the spring season starting in January for all sports, including football, which of course is a perennial fall favorite for many fans. The association says that the return to athletics in January will only occur if it is safe to do so, a decision that will be guided primarily by state and local health guidelines. Originally, the association had hoped to resume some community college sports this fall, such as cross country and golf, but that was contingent on California reaching phase four of reopenings by mid-July, a target that has not been met. Dr. Erica Andrejonis is the board chair, and she says that moving fall athletics to spring 2021 is a huge disappointment, but she adds that, quote, "The need to keep our student athletes and the amazing coaches and athletic trainers who work with them safe was simply the only option available, with the virus spiraling out of control across the state." Sports teams tentatively slated to begin practicing in mid-January and competing in February include basketball, football, soccer, women's volleyball, water polo, and wrestling, as well as golf and cross country. Some other sports will resume practices in late March and competitions in April, including badminton, baseball, beach volleyball, men's golf, softball, swimming and diving, tennis, track and field, and men's volleyball. All sports will have a 30% reduction in the maximum number of contests or competition dates permitted, and will also have regional postseason competitions, but there will be no state championships in 2020 or 2021. The decision affects about 24,000 student athletes at 110 community colleges statewide. In El Cajon, Grossmont College Associate Dean of Athletics, Nedra Brown, thanked the board for its decision and due diligence, adding, quote, "We want all student athletes to have the opportunity to participate and have a great experience. Above all, we want them to do so in the safest environment possible." This is John Sepulveda for East County Magazine.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Last year, the nonprofit Amicus built an emergency sleeping cabin as a demonstration project at a church in El Cajon. The group hopes to win city approval to allow similar units to be used to temporarily house homeless people, particularly women, including women veterans. But that requires a change in the city's zoning ordinance, which the city will consider at a public hearing of the El Cajon Planning Commission on Tuesday, July 21st at 7 p.m. to be held via teleconference due to COVID-19. The Amicus website states, "All people deserve a safe place to sleep, period. Studies have shown that extended periods of sleep deprivation take an extreme toll on our ability to function. When we're well rested, we have the best chance of being able to participate in making a healthy community." The emergency sleeping cabins can be built, fully furnished, for about $4,000, but do not include plumbing, so there are no bathroom or kitchen facilities, raising the question of where homeless residents would be able to access restrooms and shower facilities for sanitation. During the pandemic, many homeless people have said lack of bathrooms is one of the biggest problems they face in East County, with restaurants and many other facilities closed. In some other cities, more elaborate tiny homes have sometimes been built with full amenities, but at substantially higher cost. Another issue is whether the unit would be required to be on wheels to be mobile. A homeless person who formerly lived in a tiny home on wheels told me that it was hard to sleep in the unit at times due to a rocking motion similar to being on a boat. But with a shortage of shelter space in El Cajon and no shelters at all in other East County communities, emergency sleeping cabins could provide a far safer option for some homeless people to sleeping on the streets. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. This is Miriam Raftery.
California spends $4 to $5 billion a year on health care for low-income kids, but some of the health plans are falling down on the job, according to a new report out today. Researchers from the nonprofit Children Now say 40% of Medi-Cal health plans don't meet minimum standards and 70% don't do enough to ensure parents can access care for their kids. Mike O'Day with Children Now says some counties have better plans available than others.
That fundamentally means that where a child lives and which plan they're enrolled in determines whether or not they get the care they need. The way it should work is that every child in Medi-Cal gets the care that they need, especially the preventive and primary care that's guaranteed under law.
For example, in most Northern California counties, less than 10% of babies get a developmental screening. The Newsom administration is about to start negotiating contracts for plans that would take effect in 2024. Advocates want the state to make future payments contingent on better performance. O'Day would like the state to set a mandatory minimum spending level per child for preventive care and press for real results.
We could provide incentives and plans to improve health outcomes for kids or reduce health disparities. And we need to hold health plans accountable, which means meaningfully making monetary consequences tied to whether or not health plans fall below minimum performance standards.
Parents can find out how well their county's health plan is doing by checking out the report, which is available on Children Now's website. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
For the first time, deadly rabbit hemorrhagic disease has been found in San Diego County. A wild jackrabbit found dead in Poway tested positive for the disease, which can affect all rabbits, jackrabbits, hares, and pika species, including domestic rabbits. Fortunately, a vaccine has been developed, so if you own any domestic rabbits, health officials recommend that you contact your veterinarian about vaccinations for those rabbits. Infected rabbits have no symptoms before suddenly dying, though some may suffer from fever, swelling, and internal bleeding, according to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. All sick or dead rabbits should be reported to state wildlife officials and to your veterinarian immediately. Do not touch these carcasses, warn health professionals. The California Department of Food and Agriculture has issued a quarantine prohibiting any rabbit, hare, or products, including rabbit meat, pelts, hides, or carcasses that have had this disease in the past year. Importing equipment used to process rabbits is also prohibited. To protect domestic rabbits, keep them inside at all times. The highly contagious virus can be spread by contact with infected animals directly or through urine or droppings. It can also be spread through insects and other objects such as equipment. It's also important to keep in mind that when walking dogs, you need to keep them on a leash to prevent them from coming into contact with wild rabbits. If you have pet rabbits, consider having your dogs wear booties outside or wash their paws when they come indoors and keep the rabbits separated from the dogs. You also need to wash your hands thoroughly before handling rabbits. Use disinfection practices and leave your shoes outside. Also keep insects under control and be sure that your hay or feed sources are not near areas with outbreaks. The fatal disease has been found in the counties of Orange, San Bernardino, and San Diego. The first known case in California was in Palm Springs in May. The disease was earlier identified in Mexico and in the southwestern United States, in Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and Colorado. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Sepulveda.
And next up, we're going to replay one of our oldies but goodies, an interview a couple of years ago with Dick Panic from the Railway Museum in Campo. And you'll learn a little bit about San Diego's colorful railroad lore.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Dear listeners, if you love trains, and who doesn't? This conversation is for you. My guest today is Richard Pennick of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association. He was a former president and CEO, now the media coordinator, and a founding member of that 52-year-old organization. Dick Pennick, welcome.
Thank you very much, Helen. I'm pleased to be here.
Dick, you and your wife have lived in Casa de Oro for nearly 50 years. You are so steeped in East County history, we could start our conversation almost anywhere. But we're going to focus on the Railway Museum. It is impressive. Tell us where it is. Describe the size of the operation.
Thank you for asking. We like to facetiously tell some of our visitors that we're the best-kept secret in San Diego and want to keep it that way. There are still many, many thousands of people, I'm sure, that have not heard of us. And we began in the spring of 1961, right in San Diego. And even at that time, we were not the only railway history organization in town. There was an earlier one called Railway Historical Society of San Diego. And I like to think that the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum was an outgrowth of that early pioneer effort that began in the mid-1950s here. It was always the mission and the dream of Pacific Southwest Railway Museum to not only collect artifacts that represented the history and heritage of railroads, particularly in San Diego and the Pacific Southwest, but also have an opportunity to operate those items as an extension of our interpretive activities of the museum. And it took us a few years to get to the point where we could actually run something for the public, and certainly our initial efforts there were very crude. They were downtown on industrial rail spurs, all of which that are gone now.
So you truly were the heir to that. If you were downtown, you were saying downtown San Diego. But you are a nonprofit organization.
We are a nonprofit, 501c3, and probably one of the real turning points of the our organization was 1980, when we finally had an opportunity, after searching for many years, to find a site that we could construct a public railway museum and actually have an opportunity to run trains. And that occurred when we bought the property that we currently own at Campo. Initially, it was very small, 8 acres, and it has grown just in the last year to over 40 acres.
Wow.
We operate trains on a regular weekend schedule, generally weekends only. We do have a lot of charter opportunities, but we have amassed more than 100 items of historic railway rolling stock and other artifacts.
Now, in fact, aren't you operating 4 different entities under the umbrella?
We are. And at the risk of boring some of our visitors, we like to explain that certainly the Campo Living History and Train Operations Center, which we call the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, is our principal component, but we also own and operate and restored the original La Mesa Railway Station, which we call the 1894 La Mesa Depot Museum, and the portion of the San Diego and Arizona Eastern Railway that we operate our trains on each weekend. We have reacquired officially the original corporate name of the railroad, which was San Diego and Arizona Railway, when Spreckles built it in the early part of the last century.
And Spreckles is the sugar baron John Spreckles, who figures so prominently in early San Diego.
Yes, and
history.
Of course his family got their initial wealth in the sugar business in Hawaii. And they were located in San Francisco primarily in the 1880s and 1890s. And by a fluke of good luck for the city of San Diego and certainly for us, they relocated John Spreckles and his brother Adolf relocated to San Diego. And it took off. He owned the local newspaper, the waterworks, the trolley operation, and built the railroad that we operate our trains on.
So that leads us to the question, how does the ownership of the railroad track actually work? We're all used to seeing trolleys going back and forth.
Right. The railroad was owned initially by the Spreckles family. They had a majority ownership, although not 100% ownership. There was a minority stock ownership by the Harriman, Edward H. Harriman interests, until Mr. Harriman died about 1906. And just before John began to construct the San Diego and Arizona Railway. And So the Spreckles family had to make a decision whether they were going to try to go it alone without Mr. Harriman's financial help or give up the project. They elected to go ahead, and it took them 12 years to build the railroad to a connection at El Centro with all the other railroads in the country. And when Spreckles died, his family continued to run the railroad without him for a while. They finally elected to sell their majority interest to the Southern Pacific,
okay,
a railroad. And then the Southern Pacific became sole owner at that point. So that gives you a little bit of the background. And then in 1979, the Southern Pacific Railroad sold almost the entire railroad, except for a 20-some mile segment in Imperial Valley, to what was at that time called the Metropolitan Transit Development Board, a board formed to explore and initiate construction of a local light rail transit.
Okay, better known as the Little Red Trolley.
Or the, right,
with
the San Diego Trolley. That organization has morphed from Metropolitan Transit Development Board to what they now call Metropolitan Transit System.
That's about 44 miles of track, is that correct? Or 44 miles is in Mexico, going back to your earlier comment.
Right.
On the U.S. side of the border, it's MTS, or Metropolitan Transit District.
That's correct. And interestingly, okay, Metropolitan Transit Development Board, as it was called in that time, did not really want the portion of the railroad that wound through Mexico and went out through the mountains of East County, where the museum currently operates its trains. They did not want that. But the Southern Pacific says it's all or nothing, and they had to take it all. So what they've done over the years is convert all of the trackage from San Ysidro to San Diego and El Cajon to a light rail transit system.
So this really is the story of train tracks in the modern age, when everything is cars and freeways and chewed up. And yet the interesting thing is the track that runs out to East County from San Diego is the same federal track, is it not?
It's the same railroad, and major changes have been made, not so much in location, but it occupies the original right-of-way of the original railroad and some of the predecessor railroads in San Diego, in on the San Diego end, and they have a freight contractor that runs the freight trains in the evening. And then, as you said earlier,
is that the train whistle in the night?
That is the train whistle
in the
night, the midnight train
whistle.
44 miles of the track, when it was being built, were located on the Mexican side of the border between Tijuana and 8 miles east of Tecate, Baja California, for construction feasibility purposes. That portion is currently owned by the Mexican government, operated by the Mexican government.
Okay.
Its name, when Spreckles owned it, was the Tijuana and Tecate Railway. It's now called Via Corta Tijuana-Tecate, which is Tijuana-Tecate short line. Once it crosses the border east of Tecate and goes back on the U.S. side, then it's Metropolitan Transit System ownership again, all the way out to Plaster City.
So
and we operate on 14 miles of that in the Campo area.
There are deep and irrevocable ties, transportation-wise, with our sister Mexico. Dick, you have very, very beautiful vintage trains. Do movie and television companies utilize this resource?
Oh, absolutely. And we have made it a point, for obvious reasons, to make sure that the movie industry knows who we are, where we are, and what we have to offer in the way of filming opportunities. And that is not just for feature films, but also for videos, for commercials, for fashion shoots. So we've done it all. Some of the films that we've been involved in, I won't list them all, the list is long, but MacArthur, in 1976, was filmed downtown before we acquired the Campo property. And, of course, the There Goes a Train video, which so many of our family visitors refer to. We first found out about you folks, and there goes the train. Somewhat more recently, Pearl Harbor, the year 2000, was filmed in part there. Just in the last year, we've had film crews from the Lone Ranger movie and also Saving Mr. Banks. At our Campo site.
Richard, I know you have to dash back to the museum, but let's continue our conversation soon. We want to hearken back to the sound of train whistles in the night. I thank you for being here. I look forward to next time. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Debbie Stolz, president of the San Diego County Foster Parent Association based in El Cajon, was murdered along with her daughter on July 12th in Otay Mesa. The loss has sent shockwaves through local communities, foster families, and the Grossmont Cuyamaca Community College District. Stolz worked for over 20 years as a trainer for parents with Grossmont College's Foster, Adoptive, and Kinship Care Education Program. Sally Cox, the CEO of the Foundation for Grossmont and Cuyamaca Colleges, wrote in an email to staff that Stolz played an integral role in the program through her training and support for countless resource parents of foster youths in San Diego County. Stolz was a longtime employee of the foundation. She was also the mother of 8 children, 4 of them adopted. She and her daughter Lisa Stolz were shot and killed by Justice Love Peace, also known as Jeremiah Alfred Horton, the father of Lisa's 6-month-old baby. Horton kidnapped the baby, who was fortunately found safe and taken to the Polinsky Children's Center. Horton rented a vehicle and fled to Mexico, where he later committed suicide. Barbara Wojtak, program manager at Grossmont College, described Stolz as the Mother Teresa of foster care, adding she will be deeply missed. Just a week before her death, Stolz was interviewed by CBS Channel 8. In the interview, she said, "It is so very rewarding to help a child feel safe, to have some place in the world where they feel safe and wanted," adding, "I love what I do." She was slated to be featured in an upcoming Fostering Hope story on Unsung Heroes by CBS Channel 8. But she told anchor reporter Marcella Lee that the children are the real unsung heroes for their resilience and their ability to get through horrible things of being removed from their families. She also talked about the challenges of helping foster youths during the pandemic when visits are very limited. In addition, she voiced concerns about the future of the San Diego County Foster Parent Association to stay afloat during the pandemic, with rent costing about $3,000 every month. Stolz indicated that the nonprofit's reserve is fast being depleted, adding, "If things don't start getting back to normal soon, we will have to close our doors." The organization leases a building in El Cajon that it uses as a training center for foster families, also providing free clothing and other resources for foster children and foster families. The nonprofit is 100% run by volunteers with no employees, so it has been unable to qualify for any sort of small business loan or aid. Stolz asked for donations to help the organization survive, which now is left without its longtime leader. You can make a donation to the San Diego County Foster Parent Association to help foster children and families at sdcfpa.com. Again, that's the San Diego County Foster Parent Association at sdcfpa.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
And next up, we have the latest on the 2020 presidential elections from Public News Service.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The people of Florida voted to allow more than 1 million people to get their right to vote restored. And then we have legislature saying, no, again, free at last, not so fast.
The jury is still out, says civil rights attorney and law professor Gilda Daniels, on the ongoing Florida court battle over whether people with past felony convictions need to pay court fees and fines before getting their voting rights restored.
Now that's in litigation, and they're, hundreds of thousands of potential voters who are in flux don't know if they can register, don't know if they can cast a ballot.
Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a Florida court's decision to halt registrations while the case is still being appealed. In May, advocates celebrated District Judge Robert Hinkle's order, paving the way for hundreds of thousands of former felons with unpaid fees to register to vote. ACLU attorney Julie Ebenstein is still litigating the case.
The Supreme Court has not ruled one way or another on the principles that are at issue here. They've just said, we're not going to get rid of the 11th Circuit stay. We're going to leave the stay in place while the appeal is ongoing.
These would-be voters won't be able to register to vote in Florida's August state primary. The deadline is Monday. But the deadline for the general election isn't until October 5th.
We do expect that the appeal will be complete and we'll have a decision from the appellate court well before the November election.
With Florida's surging COVID-19 numbers, yesterday the Republican National Committee announced a scaled-down convention in Jacksonville, a mix of indoor and outdoor events, and only official delegates the first 3 days, about 2,500 people. Alternate delegates and guests are invited to the last day when President Trump accepts the nomination. Political scientist Karen Holt is a professor at Virginia Tech.
They'll certainly be different visually in all kinds of ways because there won't be the massive crowds and the adoring organizations and celebrations that I think especially President Trump was looking forward to.
Holt is not surprised the RNC is taking precautions, even though the initial reason for moving to Jacksonville was to avoid the restrictions required in Charlotte, North Carolina.
What they do get by moving to Florida is a much more supportive state governor, as well as, in general, a more supportive activist Republican population in Jacksonville and in closer areas around Florida. So they still will be moving to a somewhat friendlier context. And I think under the circumstances, given the outbreaks right now that are taking place in Florida, they probably had very little choice.
Democrats have made almost all convention activities virtual, and the DNC is now urging members of Congress not to attend in person either. Political donations are holding steady. The Biden campaign started July with almost $250 million. Trump had a little less than $50 million more on hand. And Kanye West, quote, has taken off the red hat, unquote. He claims he's not running for president now, but this week he or someone using his name paid $35,000 to get on the Oklahoma ballot. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
This is Miriam Raftery with an announcement for all of you listening on our Friday show. To be sure to go to KNSJ's Facebook page and sign up to listen to a special virtual book tour appearance tonight. That's July 17th at 7 p.m. Greg Palast is an internationally known investigative journalist whom we've interviewed before right here on our show. Now he's got a provocative new book out titled How Trump Stole 2020, The Search for America's Vanished Voters. KNSJ Radio's founder Martin Eder calls Palast a no-holds-barred journalist who's exactly the kind of watchdog our democracy has to have to survive. This Friday night, Palast will tell listeners what his latest investigations have found. Now, this event is a fundraiser to benefit KNSJ's nonprofit public radio station, and you can reserve tickets on KNSJ's Facebook page. And that's by donation, so nobody will be turned away if you can't pay. Large donors will be mailed a copy of Palast's book and other premiums to support local community radio on KNSJ. Palast, a best-selling New York Times author, has been covering the story of elections for years. This virtual event will highlight an interview with Amy Goodman and Noam Chomsky. Palast is one of the country's foremost experts on voter suppression and election fraud. He's been featured by the BBC, The Guardian, The Nation, and Rolling Stone magazine. He has exposed some of the biggest scandals of the last century. The award-winning investigative reporter, four-time New York Times bestselling author, and documentary filmmaker shines a light on the truth, helping expose historic controversies, including the Shoreham Nuclear Power Station project, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, Deepwater Horizon, and the 2000 and 2016 U.S. presidential elections. Now Palast turns his attention to the 2020 presidential election with his latest book. Again, that's titled How Trump Stole 2020, The Hunt for America's Vanished Voters. That's this Friday night, July 17th, from 7 o'clock to 9:30 p.m., and you can sign up for the Zoom book tour at KNSJ's Facebook page. The appearance will also be on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and broadcast on KNSJ 89.1 FM, as well as online at knsj.org. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.